This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me John Francis. He's the author of The Ragged Edge of Silence, Finding Peace in a Noisy World. He's also the founder and director of the environmental group Planet Walk, and he's an associate professor right now at the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. John Francis, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks very much, Matt.
You know, I just got done reading this book of yours that came out last year, The Ragged Edge of Silence, and it's fascinating to me because of your experiments and how you lived your life. You went many years without talking and many years without walking. Many years walking, many years without riding in a car or a motorized vehicle, so I want to get to some of that. You write that you started... Or you had an awakening in 1971 with this oil spill, which I'd forgotten about, by the way, in the San Francisco Bay. Tell me how that affected you.
Yeah, well, you know, I hadn't really thought much about environment up until that time. I mean, there was a spill in Santa Barbara, but that was in Santa Barbara. And I was in Marin County in near San Francisco. So it wasn't such a big deal for me. But when I heard that there was a spill in San Francisco, I had to go see it. And fortunately, I couldn't see it, but I could smell it. And the smell was just so overpowering.
What did it smell like?
It smelled like, you know, 1,000 gas stations. You know, and as a little kid, you know, riding in a hot summer car and getting jounced and bounced around in no air conditioning and the windows up or something. It was pretty awesome, you know, and I guess the thing that really impacted on me the most there were two things. One was that I couldn't get away from it. It was all pervasive. And the other thing was that birds were being affected. Birds were washing up on the shore. And I can remember as a child trying to save a little robin in Philadelphia in the hot city street there. And that didn't happen. A car rode over it. And I remembered that robin, and I always thought about birds as something that were really important to me.
Now, let's just fast forward a little bit to the BP oil spill a couple years ago. There are a lot of pictures of birds covered with oil there. What was your reaction when you saw that happen, saw the BP spill?
My reaction was, I'm wondering if we're ever going to learn anything. And I didn't know what to do. I wasn't going to give up riding in cars right away. And actually, I was a National Geographic education fellow. So a colleague of mine and I, we rode down to actually see what was going on and talk to the people who were involved in being affected by the spill. So, I mean, I was kind of sickened, you know, and hoping that there's something else we could do. But, you know, this thing seems to go on and we don't seem to learn from our mistakes. And
what did people tell you there that you went down and talked with?
Well, they were saying that the government and BP weren't doing the things that they promised. There was one fisherman who I guess is shell fisherman, shrimper, who was taught that, well, you can actually tell whether the shrimp are contaminated or not by smelling them. And he took a course on smelling his shrimp, and he showed us very proudly, sarcastically, I guess, the certificate which said that he could actually smell if his shrimp were contaminated or not. And he said he's not going to eat them.
He didn't believe it.
He didn't believe it.
He didn't believe his own certificate. Yeah. I'm speaking with John Francis, who's the author of The Ragged Edge of Silence, Finding Peace in a Noisy World. So then to flash backward, after that oil spill in 1971 San Francisco Bay, you decided that day that you weren't going to ride in a car, at least for that day. What happened?
Well, I asked my girlfriend. I said, we were driving to the oil spill, and it was hard to escape the fact that the oil washing up in the bay had something to do with the automobiles we were driving. And so I said, hey, let's give up riding and driving in cars. And she laughed at me and said, no, you know, we don't have enough money, you know, to do that. And this was way before Forrest Gump. So she said people would just laugh at us, you know, walking, and, you know, they'd say, hey, look at those bums. They don't have any money, and they can't afford to ride. And but if we waited and we got enough money, we would be able to cachet that into, hey, look at those people walking. They're rich. They must know something. Let's follow them. And you know, I bought that.
You not only bought it, you paid for it over and over again. I mean, you spent 22 years not riding in a motorized vehicle. Is that right?
That's right.
And so how did you get around?
Well, I walked.
And wasn't it a huge inconvenience?
Well, it was. You know, it was an inconvenience in the sense that I couldn't keep up with my friends because they were driving. If someone wanted to play volleyball in the next town, say Point Reyes Station, it took me about an hour and a half. It's only 4 miles away, but it took me about an hour or you know, depending on how fast I was going to walk. It took them 5 minutes to get there. And by the time I got there, they would be finished the game, and you know, I couldn't walk there and get back in the same amount of time. So it was sort of the John Henry kind of metaphor of trying to keep up with the steel machines, the steel ponies.
And it had not only recreational implications, but occupational ones too. You were doing a job with setting up jazz performance, jazz gigs, and you lost that. You couldn't do that. I mean, what?
Yeah, I lost that because, you know, I couldn't get around and make up these the gigs. I couldn't get there, and, you know, and eventually I was a fireman and volunteer fireman, and they said, well, John, you could do that. You can't run behind the car. So I said, I could run beside the fire truck, or, you know, I could get to the fire in our little town because there's lots of trails. I could get there before the truck could get there. And, you know, the fire chief, Dick, he said, John, it just wouldn't engender, you know, confidence to see you running beside the fire truck. So they let me be a dispatcher.
You had, and then you did some walk. You walked across the country at one point, and what inspired you to do that?
It was just as part of my education. When I went to college, I did go to college, and the one important thing, which we didn't say anything about before I went to college was, and before I walked across the country, is I stopped talking.
And why did you stop talking?
Well, you know, living in a little town where everybody knows everyone, and you start walking and you won't get in the car, it made a lot of arguments happen. And I argued with people all the time about whether one person could make a difference. And I decided that on my 27th birthday, I was going to do something different. And I thought, well, gosh, what can I do? I'm going to give my community a gift. That's what I was going to do. I'm going to not speak for one day. And it was a great gift for them. They loved that.
But one day turned into 17 years. And you write in this book, John Francis, The Ragged Edge of Silence, when you first stopped talking, you weren't overwhelmed by this positive feeling. Actually, you were struck by the dissonance of your thoughts. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, you know, once you stop talking, there are all those conversations that you keep having with yourself about you said this, they said that, you should have said this, they could have said that. And then you keep replaying those over and over and over. So it gets kind of crazy inside. But if you stick with it, I discovered that those conversations go away, because the practice of not speaking and listening, and that's the other thing that happened to me, is that I realized I had not been listening to folks when they talked to me. I thought I knew everything at that point. And so I would only listen just enough to hear what someone was going to say. And I was already thinking about what I was going to say back. I didn't even listen to them. I mean, I already just assumed I knew what they were going to say.
Yeah, one of the great parts about this book, The Ragged Edge of Silence, is the importance of listening, the importance of listening so that you can find out more about other people and find out more about yourself. And you say in the book that by not talking, you were able to overcome self-deception, that you were living a lie, especially as an African. You were forced to live a lie as a black man in America. I lied in order to pretend, was one of the lines in the book. Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, you know, as I grew up, even in my family that, you know, we loved each other and they loved me, and we were still surrounded by what media, what the society, what the culture was telling me was that, you know, John, you could be a criminal or you could be a comedian or maybe a sports figure. If you're really good, and you know how many of us can get to be Jackie Robinson, you know, and at that time that he was our hero, Joe Louis, but I wasn't able to see who I really was be anything other than those kinds of people, and I wanted to be something different. I knew I was something different, but I didn't know exactly what it was. But in the culture, African Americans were not really allowed to discover who they were. They had to be something other than who they were. And that's what I did, you know, pretend to be other people.
And in a sense, we all pretend to be someone else a lot of the time, or many of us do. You know, we put on a costume or we do our professional role or we put on a face. And then by not talking, it's harder to keep that costume on, I suppose.
Yeah, it's you know, hard to keep well, you know, I guess my parents, when they finally came out to see me, thought I was wearing a costume because I didn't look like anybody else. But it's hard to really lie or make things up. I mean, because there you are. I mean, you're just who you are and you're not using words or ideas to try and be someone else.
Well, tell me about the reaction of your parents. Your dad had a hard time coming to grips with you not talking and not driving a car. Give up this craziness, he said more than once. I mean, did he ever reconcile himself?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and he did. You know, first when I stopped riding in cars, you know, my parents were like, well, that's only going to last for a couple of weeks. And my dad wanted to know why I didn't do that when I was like 16. You know, could have saved him a lot of dough because I had to have a car, you know. When I stopped talking and I wrote my parents from California, they're back in Philadelphia, that I had stopped talking, you know, my mother wrote me and said, your dad will be on the next plane, buddy, because they're coming from a, you know, a working class family in the East Coast, and their son is living in California, doesn't ride in cars, so he can't come home and visit them. And now he doesn't talk, so he can't call him up. And, you know, they're thinking I had been co-opted or, you know, kidnapped by some strange religious cult in California. So my dad did show up to find me and
to deprogram you, maybe.
Exactly. You know, and I was worried about that. I thought they might want to do something like that. But it turned out that he called my mother from a hotel where we had gone to stay, and he had gone to stay, and I went to visit him there. And he called my mother, and he said, look, let's just leave him out here. Because people seem to like him. I mean, he seems to be getting along. He doesn't smoke. He doesn't drink. He's, you know, he doesn't do drugs. So let's leave him out here because, you know, this wouldn't work in Philadelphia. This is not talking and riding around.
And he did seem to take pleasure in your academic success. You went to college, you got a master's degree, you got a PhD, the whole nine yards. And then you got some coverage because look at this guy who doesn't talk, who just and walks everywhere and just got all these degrees.
Right. He did, you know, and I mean, both my parents did, but my dad particularly, who followed me as I started walking across the United States. And first up in Oregon, I went to Southern Oregon State College there and got my undergraduate degree, and he shows up and he says, you know, look, we're really proud of you, but, you know, what are you going to do with a BS degree if you don't ride in cars and talk? And the same in Montana when I did my master's in environmental studies. He, you know, said, gosh, you know, you walked all this way, you studied, you get your master's degree, but what are you going to do with a master's degree when you don't ride in cars and talk? You're just going to have to give that stuff up. That's crazy.
And no. did you have good answers for him?
Yeah, I hunched my shoulders, I picked my banjo up and grabbed my backpack and walked out, you know, until finally I get to Wisconsin. And here I'm at the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And he shows up and I'm a fellow, you know, an advanced opportunity fellow. And he's looking around my apartment, and it's not far from where we are. And he says, you know, my sister said I should just leave you alone because you seem to be doing so much better when you're not saying anything. And he said, then he says, goes back into, but what are you going to do with a PhD when you don't ride in cars and talk, you know? And, you know, I just kind of hunched my shoulders and...
It's funny, you say you were, when you were in California, you were accepted by everyone, and your dad realized that. In this book, John Francis, The Ragged Edge of Silence, you talk about a sheriff who called you walking, no talking John. Mm-hmm. I laughed when I saw that, but it came after a harrowing experience that you had walking along the road when some rednecks in a pickup stopped. I want you to say what happened then.
Well, you know, I was walking alone on a road and isolated, and a pickup truck stopped, and I kind of, the hackles went up, and I could feel something. And one of them called me over as I was walked by the truck, you know, and he goes, "Hey, boy, come here."
And how old were you then?
It's like, I'm, you know, what, 30 or something? I'm definitely beyond the boy stage. And but I understood what he meant. And when I walked over and I put my hand on the roof of his, my shoulder or my arm on the roof of the truck and looked in at the truck and you know, he pulled up a gun and put it to my head, and he said, "You know, we don't like your kind here," but he didn't say it in such a nice way. He said, "Well, you know, click," and he shot the gun, but the gun misfired.
Oh, he pulled the trigger.
He pulled the trigger, and he just said, "Well, you get going." Now, there were two of them in the car, and the other guy was pretty nervous, and I motioned with my fingers that I'm walking this way. And he said, "Well, you get going," and I just kind of walked off. And
did you feel like throwing up? You must have felt so nauseous.
The most amazing thing happened to me at that moment. It was like I recognized everyone. I recognized myself. I recognized this person, and this person was death, and death personified. And I was like, "Oh, I know who you are. You're death." And like my best friend. It was like meeting my best friend. And as I walked away, you know, I realized that, well, death's going to find you. Death is with us all the time. I mean, without death, we couldn't have life. And to see that and to feel that, in one moment, one flash, was what happened at that moment. And then I got scared.
The messenger of death doesn't have to be so disgusting always. We're all going to meet that. But we hope not in such a hideous, awful, racist way that you encountered then. But for the grace of God, you wouldn't be sitting right here talking with me. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My fascinating guest today is John Francis. He's the author of The Ragged Edge of Silence, Finding Peace in a Noisy World. He's the founder of an environmental group called Planet Walk, and he's an associate professor at the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. So you went 22 years without riding in a motorized vehicle, and you went 17 years without speaking, with one brief exception when you called your mom, which was a sweet moment in the book. Why did you relent on both of these fronts, the motorized vehicle front and the speaking front?
Yeah. Well, the speaking, you know, every year on my birthday, I ask myself, is this still appropriate? And it was for 17 years or for 16 years. And then the last one, I decided that it was time for me to start speaking. And this is after I had gotten my degrees, all a PhD, studied in environmental studies. And I had this informal education of walking around and getting to meet all kinds of people. And with that degree, with the formal education and the informal education in environmental studies, I got to the place where, yes, you know, it's really important about pollution. That when I started walking, that's what was really on my mind, pollution. Loss of species, climate change, all those things are really important. But if people are part of the environment, then what our first opportunity to treat the environment in a sustainable way, or even to understand what sustainability means, is in our relationship with ourselves and with each other. So environment became also about human rights and civil rights and economic equity and gender equality and all the ways that we relate to each other. So it's, for me as a walker, it's how you treat each other when we meet each other. And so that was a message I had, and I wanted to start speaking that and saying that. And I started speaking on Earth Day to remind myself that, yes, I am going to speak, but I want to speak for the environment. And that's the message that I had.
And so this was like the 20th anniversary of Earth Day, right?
Yes, it was in Washington, D.C. But I still maintained the non-motorized part of me and walked. And I use bicycles when I get into a certain place. I would use a bicycle. But I rode my bicycle up to Vermont. I was named a UN Goodwill Ambassador for the Environment Program, United Nations Environment Program. And then I was hired by the Coast Guard to help write regulations for the United States after the Exxon Valdez, because my degree was in land resources, and I had written on oil spills and was the only one in the United States at that time studying at a PhD level writing on oil spills. I worked at the Coast Guard for a year.
Did you go up to Alaska then?
I used satellite imagery and video conferencing, which while I worked at the Coast Guard, those are the things that they agreed that we could do. And I would ride my bike if it was in 300 miles, I needed to go somewhere. And we could send people, because I was a project manager, if it was beyond that and I didn't need to be there. But after the Coast Guard, I went sailing through the Caribbean, and I spent about 2 years there until I got to Venezuela sailing, and then started walking. It was in Venezuela, as I walked through a town called El Dorado, it's a prison town where the prison is outside the town, and I was challenged by a guard there for my passport. And I believed I was in a disguise, and I was trying to escape prison. And I told him, no, I don't need to show you my passport, you know, because I'm Dr. Francis. I'm a UN ambassador, and I'm walking around the world. And they didn't shoot me. I just kind of walked off and saying, wow, I'm going to escape. And I walked into the forest, and I realized that, you know, what was I doing? It's not like me to do that. It turned out that, yes, I was in prison. And the prison was one of my own making. It was that I didn't ride in motorized vehicles. Not that it wasn't an appropriate decision when I made it, but over the years, that decision became a prison because I never revisited that decision. I never gave myself the opportunity to think about it and say, oh, well, things have changed. I need to change as well. And that's what I had to do. And so I had no idea I was going to be a PhD, a UN Goodwill Ambassador. And then I also left my parents back in Philadelphia, which I probably wouldn't get to see again if I just kept walking. So I got in the VW bus when I got to the border of Brazil, which is several hundred miles away still, and rode the bus, flew back to Philadelphia, scared my parents who thought I was gone forever. And what I decided to do was to go back and forth and continue walking, because walking was a really good way of knowing.
They must have been pleased to see you for sure, your parents. Tell me about this organization, Planet Walk, that you founded, John Francis.
Well, Planet Walk is an organization that I founded in with a group of friends back in 1982, after getting my undergraduate degree. And that's because I had, with a degree, I came up with a short-term goal, which was to finish school. The long-term goal was to walk around the world as part of my education in the spirit and hope I could be a benefit for humankind, but I had no idea what that meant. And my friend said, John, we need an organization to support you and to support the things that you like to do. What do you want to do? And it was to raise environmental consciousness and in my journey and through education and publications and things like that. And so that's what we did. We formed this organization, and right now we're developing Planet Lines, which is a walking curriculum K through 12. It's getting the students outside to walk, because we all make a line as we walk, and to gather data. So we're using GIS and GPS technology to gather quantitative and qualitative data that we can share with other planet walkers and who are making other planet lines, so we get to know our communities in a much deeper way.
I imagine that'll be eye-opening for the students, too.
It'll be eye-opening, and I hope they get a little bit of physical exercise doing it, too.
One thing, we've got about a minute left in the Ragged Edge of Silence. You stress the importance of practicing silence. Some kind of meditativeness. Why is that so crucial? Is there one practice that you could describe that you think is especially useful?
Well, I think that silence is something really good for us to to practice, trying to find that silence or returning to that silence, because it's a way of learning to listen. Not only listening to the things around us, but listening to something maybe that is hard to explain or describe inside of us. And it is a very good way to find out who we are and where we're going.
Well, maybe we'll just take 10 seconds of silence, which you often don't get on radio, and then we'll say goodbye. So, John Francis, it's been a delight to having you as my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Well, thanks very much, Matt, for having me.
And I highly recommend his book, The Ragged Edge of Silence. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor of the Progressive Magazine. You've been listening to Progressive Radio.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.